welcome to WNHH Radio's Dateline New Haven. I'm your host, Paul Bass, inviting you to look behind the headlines on the stories that make the Elm City tick. Lori Sweet has come back home with a story to tell. She has just returned from Tornillo, is that how you say it?
Yep.
Tornillo, Texas, where 2,324 teen boys and girls, at last count, are living in a migrant tent city guarded by the U.S. government as they seek to have a home here. She's here in the WNHH studio. Tell us about it. Welcome back, Lori. It's great
thank
to get
you
back. And we'll touch back later about why you've been here before.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for having me.
But Lori, tell us, what brought you to Tornillo? And what is Tornillo?
Yeah, so I have been volunteering with an organization called Immigrant Families Together since August. Our main efforts are reuniting families, paying out bonds, getting children out of detention centers, moving people through detention centers.
And these are people mostly from Latin America who are trying to cross the border.
Correct.
And don't have permission to come to America, and under a new family separation policy, they get removed from their parents and put in these separate facilities.
That's correct. So that work for me began in August, and when the head of IFT, as we call it, Immigrant Families Together, notified me of an opportunity to go to Tornillo, I couldn't say no. I paid my own way to go, and I needed to witness for myself what the process looked like. I needed to look at the children with my own eyes and see what was happening at our border instead of reading about it. As we know, the news can be biased one way or the other, and I just needed to see for myself what was happening in this tent city south of El Paso, about 30, 40 minutes south in the middle of nowhere. I needed to go and look with my own eyes, and I needed to experience it. So it was a pilgrimage organized by a number of faith leaders. Some rabbis, some fathers.
These are national, not local.
Yeah, national, across the United States.
Are you involved in the faith community?
I am not. But Faith in Action was the group that helped us organize and helped us with press releases and just giving us all the relevant information that we needed.
So you decided this has been a journey for you even before you went there. It's part of a broader journey into activism.
Absolutely.
Do you have a history of this?
You know,
political campaigns, social justice movements?
Yeah, I would say, you know, I have young children. They're 5 and 8 now. So it's been a little bit difficult for me to be as involved as I would like to be. But it was really, for me, it was the Nasty Women movement in 2017, working with Lucy very closely, that really kind of brought me out. And I felt like I couldn't
believe. Like many people who you were inspired by the results of the 2016 election.
Exactly.
And that got you involved in activism. And are you primarily a mom? Do you also, for how you spend your days, but you're also active in the Westfield Community Nursery School?
Yeah, I do lots of different things. I wear lots of different hats. I'm a mom.
So you decided, when did you leave on this pilgrimage to Tornillo?
We left on November 14th.
When did you get back?
I got back the 16th, but...
Went 3 days.
Yeah, some folks did pilgrimage from their home states of Michigan, Seattle, Massachusetts. So there was a caravan. That wasn't feasible for me for a number of reasons, but I flew down to be part of the pilgrimage.
What did you see? So, Lori, you said you went down there to see with your own eyes what you've been reading about.
Correct.
About the children who are separated from the parents who are coming here for a better life. What did you see?
So our first stop was in El Paso at the United States-Mexico border. There is an international bridge there. Some folks, I didn't have my passport, and I promised my mother that I would not get arrested that day, so I actually didn't participate in this part. I watched. So the first step was to be at the border. You pay 50 cents to cross into Mexico. Then you wait in line and you pay another 50 cents to get into the United States.
It's such a funny price.
It's weird, right?
Yes.
It's really bizarre.
Why bother?
And there are plenty of folks.
The cost of processing, I wonder if it costs more than 50 cents.
Right? And there are plenty of folks who live in Mexico and cross into El Paso or vice versa all the time. So this is a normal spot to enter. However, it's not so easy to enter now. If you don't have papers, if you're, you know, quote unquote illegal, there's long lines, and we were able to see U.S. Border Patrol standing right up and into the line where Mexico is and basically blocking people from presenting themselves at a port of entry, which is how you do that, and claiming asylum. So there's a long backlog of people waiting on this bridge.
So your group wasn't at risk of that because they were allowed in this country?
Correct. However, there were some people, even with a U.S. passport, who were detained briefly and questioned. I'm not sure. I wonder if they wondered why they were, you know, quickly
Israel
in and out.
Does that. They always bring, they question people, come in, and they're actually sophisticated at it when they see people who look like they might be here to create a threat. Lately, they've gotten in trouble because it's turned out illogical. People get in a list from this right-wing group about whether they don't have a view that the right-wing government agrees with. But over time, they've saved a lot of lives by checking. When you go to Israel, you know you can't joke around, and they're looking for stuff you won't notice that they're not specifically asking about that have signs of someone who's going to hurt people.
Yes.
Is that the situation down there, or is this more intimidation to keep people from coming to the country?
I think it's intimidation. I think having witnessed or been helping people who have been a part of the entire process from crossing all the way to rehousing here, it's all about intimidation and deterring them. One of the things that we're doing is when people do cross and they are detained, they're put in what's called ice boxes. It's 56 degrees. It's freezing. They're given very little food, very little water.
Is this like where they're permanently staying? Or?
This is a brief.
Like for how long?
4 days.
Oh, 4 days.
A week.
And is that with their families together?
So there's a family that I'm working with right now. The mom was breastfeeding and was luckily not separated from her baby. But this is where they were separating families. So they would separate mom from dad and mom from children. And the idea, at least my understanding, is that they wanted people to sign voluntary deportation orders. So they're basically torturing them and hoping that they can just get them to leave of their own volition, and it's just one less person to deal with. However, having listened to the stories of the people coming to our border seeking asylum, the ice boxes are a cakewalk next to what they have been through to get to the border or what they left behind. So many aren't deterred. It's not really working. I feel like we're needlessly torturing people because they're going to persevere. They already
have seen the ice box interview.
I did not see the ice box interview, but the family I'm helping described what it was like for them in the ice box and the baby. You know, it's their boxes.
And did you meet the family while you were there?
No, this family is local that I'm helping, but they went through the same process.
Okay, so that happened before.
Mm-hmm,
so
yeah.
I want to get back in this interview to talk about the family you're helping.
Yeah.
But first, I want to remind people that they're listening to Dateline New Haven. And Lori Sweet, a local woman who decided she just needed to see for herself what was happening at our border with Mexico and with families trying to get in. And she's just come back from what she describes as a pilgrimage with a group called Immigrant Families Together. And she's telling that on Dateline New Haven, WNHH, your home for community radio at 103.5 FM, live streamed at newhavenindependent.org. So Lori, you went down there day one. You watched your colleagues' experience going both ways on the border. What else happened on day one?
So that was day one in the morning. I did not cross. I stayed, and my mom was happy about that, although there was a little bit of trouble later in the afternoon. I'll get to that. So our next stop after we all assembled was to get on a bus together. There were 120 of us all together from all different faiths, all different regions in the United States. Some local folks joined us as well from El Paso, and we got on the bus, and we made the journey to Tornillo.
Where was this border crossing?
The first one was the El Paso Bridge.
Right. Okay,
Tornillo, I mean, you could walk into Tornillo and cross into Mexico, which is what we were told we were allowed to do. But if we wanted to go up...
Wait a second, what does that mean? You're allowed to be in an American city, Tornillo town, walk into Mexico? I thought we
only if you want to walk to Mexico is what we were told.
Oh, but not back.
Right, and if you wanted to gain access to the children or even just to the front desk of, I don't even know if there's a front desk, but like to access the people in charge of these tents, we were denied access. We were told we needed to put something in writing. And I wish I had known that because I would have attempted to do that. So we knew having had, there's a man named Josh Rubin who is living in an RV. His Facebook is Witness: Tornillo. And he's been living and watching, and he said that he hasn't been able to gain access, and he said it was unlikely that anybody else would. And of course, we were denied access. We were told by, and I'm not sure if he was Border Patrol, or I'm not sure, we'll call him Officer Turk. There's a live stream of this on my Facebook page, that we could go up along the fence and see in. And he said that people have been able to do that. That seemed like a safe option if we really were determined to see in the Tornillo camps for ourselves. So many of my colleagues and fellow pilgrimage participants got back on the bus and went off to do acts of service. And myself and a small group decided with Josh that we would go and see for ourselves. So we walked one length of the tents. And
so there's a tent city.
There's a tent city.
What's the gate? Is it a fence? Is it wire?
It's all fenced with barbed wire. There's big mounds of earth and officers on top of the mounds of earth. So we started walking, and they have recently, in the last 2 weeks, added this black plastic covering so that you can't see in and the children can't see out. So we walked the entire length of one of the walls, you know, one of the fences, and then we took a right and we kept walking. At this point, we knew we were on someone else's property. It was a cotton farmer, and we walked until we could see in, so until the black tarp stopped, and there were guards, and we were finally able to make eye contact with some of the 13 to 17 year old. We mostly saw boys, though there are girls in there as well, walking single file between the tents. The other thing that was really alarming to me is that as we turned and we were, again, trying to make eye contact with the children in the tents, there was a loudspeaker that got louder and louder and louder and louder in Spanish, so that as we were yelling, "You are not alone," in Spanish, they couldn't hear us at all.
Was it deliberate because of that? Did they see what you were doing?
I think it was deliberate. I don't know. Mm-hmm. So we walked until we could lay eyes on the children. I had a sign that said, "Free our families," or "Families Belong Together," something of that sort. And we chanted until the owner of the property came out and told us that we were trespassing on private property and wanted to know why we cared so much about these children, and told us that we needed to get off the property or he was going to call the sheriff. So we said, "Call the sheriff." So we called the sheriff, and by the time we were done our, you know, small civil disobedience of,
you know. But you told your mom you weren't going to get arrested.
I did not get arrested.
You did risk it there.
We did risk it. Yes. I walked.
Just use the word civil disobedience.
Yes. I walked back, and as I was walking back, the sheriff and a number of other police came and blocked in the one car of a reporter who was there and hassled them about trespassing. But the rest of us just walked back.
Oh, there was a reporter there from where?
There was a reporter there. The coverage was in Spanish, actually. I can share with anybody who's interested some of the coverage. But that particular coverage, there was some video footage, was in Spanish, and I said to them afterwards, "I'm sorry about that," and they said, "We go where the news is," and you guys were the news in that moment. The rally was wonderful and lovely, and we sang, but I don't know that we made an impact on the children, and that's why I had to push it a little bit and actually go and see them for myself and make eye contact, and that was really important to me. During the rally, we would pause, we would have a moment anytime a bus came through, and we know that the maximum capacity is about 3,800 children that could be in this tent. I can assure you they are getting up to capacity because we're seeing more tents being brought in, toilets, heaters, and just bus after bus of children.
Now, when you spoke to the owner of the farm, was this owner sympathetic to the government? Did you have any kind of exchange back and forth
about
what he thinks? So what did he think, and did it affect what you think?
It did not affect what I think. He told us that land had been seized by the federal government and taken over.
His land.
And
did he get compensated?
I don't know. That's a
eminent domain. You're supposed to get paid.
I think he probably got paid. He told us that he didn't understand why we cared so much about those children. He didn't care about those children. And I said, well, they're kids with families, you know, waiting for them, aunts, uncles, moms, dads. Many of them, you know, they crossed unaccompanied. Well, some of them were separated and some of them crossed with relatives, and they're trying to be rejoined with their family members. And now they're in this, what should be a temporary camp structure. But as far as I can tell, there's no attempt to get them on to the next step, which is reunification. I'm worried they're going to be placed in foster care. So I've actually worked on a couple of cases, for lack of a better word, of reuniting mothers and their children who crossed unaccompanied. And the mother and every member of that household that lives with the mother has to be fingerprinted in order to get their own children. The mother birthed this child.
So what did the farmer tell you about why he doesn't care, or what he thinks
you are?
He
doesn't care. His line, and this is a line that I have heard before, is that the U.S. government is saving these children from human trafficking, and that it's actually very nice in there, that they have soccer fields, they have ice cream once a week, they have movies for them, that they're actually in very good care. But the hypocrisy of it all that I want to highlight is that the people working with these children have not been fingerprinted. They sign up to do this job through BCFS, which is the Baptist Children and Family Services. And I understand, you know, more children are coming daily. They're coming from Florida. They're coming from California. They're coming from all over the border into this camp city. However, why do the parents have to be fingerprinted in order to get the children, but the people working with the children...
Have you heard reports about it not being okay in there?
Yes. I have heard horrific reports of abuse, physical abuse, sexual abuse. I've heard reports of children being sedated. Children are being vaccinated. Children are being treated for, you know, simple things like a UTI, and when the mom calls to check in on her child, she says, you know, how is so-and-so doing? Oh, she's fine. And they don't mention any of these things.
What's a UTI?
Urinary tract infection. Oh. Very, very common, because they don't have easy access to bathrooms. They have to ask to go, and they're not well hydrated. So it's a pretty common thing that when children get released, they have a packet with their alien number. They'll have a medical report, and many of them have been treated, even though the social worker will tell us that they haven't been treated. So I don't understand why we aren't doing more rigorous background checks for the people daily engaging with these children, not to mention the trauma of having them in these places where, you know, they can see daylight above, but they can't see out. Our rules for children in these situations is that there should be a mental health clinician, one per every 12. And in Tornillo, the numbers, there's some discrepancies. There was just a report out in the LA Times that said, it was a spokesperson for BCFS, that it was 1 to 50. Others have reported 1 to 100. Clearly, that is not enough clinicians to help these children who have now been, you know, Thanksgiving not so meaningful to folks from Central America, but that may be spending Christmas in these tents. You know, they've suffered trauma to get here, and we're further traumatizing them, and then we're not providing clinicians for them to talk to. The other thing that I really struggle with is that, and I understand why, but you can't touch the children. You're not allowed to hug them. They're not allowed to hug each other. And
you can't hug each other?
No.
You can't hug your friend?
Nope.
I understand your first part. They're worried about getting abused. It's a really terrible...
But no hugging.
It's a terrible conundrum when you're working with children in facilities, because kids need to be hugged.
Mm-hmm.
And they are vulnerable to people like to prey on
children.
They
need touch. They really need touch. So, you know, I want to highlight that this is happening, that there's money being spent. I was reading something last night. I think it's... $430 million is the price tag for these tents. So worse than you can even imagine. People are profiting off of this.
Lori Sweet is telling you what she saw in Tornillo, Texas, when she went to see for herself what's happening at the border. She's telling you that on Dateline New Haven on WNHH-FM, your home for community radio, 103.5 FM. Live streamed at newhavenindependent.org. So was that it for day one, or did you have other?
So day one was the witnessing at the International Bridge. We had our our witnessing in Tornillo and our civil disobedience. And then the afternoon was spent doing acts of service. So the goal was to see the whole process. Obviously, I would never say that I'm acting in the footsteps of immigrants, because we did fast for the day, but they're fasting for many, many days, not by choice. But the idea was to see the process from start to finish. So to start where they might cross, or in many cases, the ports are closing in San Diego. So say you did cross, the next step would be a detention center. We couldn't gain access to one of those, but we have people who have been released from detention centers. We have a pretty good idea of what their experience is like there. And then ICE is dumping them
Immigration and Customs.
Yeah, dumping them in the streets of El Paso. They have started working with a wonderful organization called the Annunciation House, where I sent donations and money. The shelter itself there, we did visit. We had a little tour. Can't hold very many, maybe 14, 20 people. But they're working with a number of basically pop-up shelters around El Paso. And so ICE has started working with them. In one day, they might get 300 people being released from detention. And they'll call Annunciation House. They'll bring people to Annunciation House. And Annunciation House will say, we can take 10 today. 30 need to go here. 100 need to go here. Another 30 here. And the rest we're going to have to put up in a hotel.
So, Lori, when you're watching this and thinking about people, you know, this issue, there are two realities about immigration that we have in this country. Right? Many of us in this New Haven area are sympathetic to the people coming to the country. Mm-hmm. Half the country agrees with Donald Trump that right. It's a danger to the country and we have to have rules that are enforced a certain way. When you saw this, what did you conclude the country should be doing differently at the border crossing, at Tornillo, the camp, at the place where they dump them in El Paso?
So we are spending tons of money on troops, on border patrol. The day that we were in El Paso, a helicopter flew overhead for the entire day. That has to be costing us a lot of money. What I would like to see, and what others, Congress people, representatives have recommended, is instead of meeting their asylum seekers, we can talk about that too, instead of greeting immigrants with rubber bullets and tear gas or just blocking them from coming, why aren't we sending down social workers, ICE officials who could process them more quickly? I mean,
you're saying invest in beefing up the process.
Yes.
To have more people have their claims taken seriously and treated humanely in the process.
Yes, instead of this fear. I mean, we have created this crisis. There have people have been migrating from Central America, from Europe, from all over the world from the beginning of America's history. This is not a new occurrence, but we have. Well, our president has made this an issue. The camp at Tornillo is a prototype. That concerns me greatly. This is a prototype. It was set up as temporary housing. There's no plans to shut it down. It's growing. Are there going to be other tent cities in the middle of nowhere, Texas, where more children are brought? I don't know, but I'm very concerned about that. The Flores Agreement says that you can only detain somebody for 20 days. Well, because these are emergency shelters, they get around that. And there's children in other places that I've worked with who've been detained for 70 days. There's children who've been detained since March, and lawyers are having to fight. We could send lawyers, immigration lawyers, to process and get, I mean, on the other end of things, the family that I'm working with is going to be applying for asylum. They are most definitely asylum seekers. But the court, if they were to go to court right now, their hearing date would be around 2021. So we've created this tremendous backlog, and we've created more hoops to families being reunited, like the fingerprinting. We've made this a crisis. It was not a crisis before. It was a normal thing that happened. And now with extra security at the border, Border Patrol blocking people from coming in, now we have people living on bridges. We have asylum seekers. I'm in touch with a gentleman in Brownsville, Texas. He goes 7 days a week between 6 a.m. and 8 a.m. and feeds the asylum seekers living on the bridge. Then he goes to work. Then he comes back and he helps people get on the right buses. Sometimes he houses them. He gives them phone numbers for contacts, because once they are detained, many of them will then have a bond. So we have to raise money for bonds to get them out to ensure that they go to their court. If they don't have anybody on the other side of detention, we're working on sponsors, families, individuals who can write a letter that says, I'm going to take care of this individual. I'm going to house them. I'm going to be financially responsible. I'm going to make sure they get to their court dates. And I'm going to, asylum seekers, anybody, any immigrant coming here, they're not allowed to work until their asylum application has been received. And even then, I think they have to wait for 3 months. So
very sweet. People who generally agree in this country that we should be welcoming immigrants, investing in a fair process rather than military options, do not necessarily agree on the long game.
Right.
And a lot of times, because people are speaking up against injustices about what happens day to day, they avoid the tougher questions. So the debate going on within the pro-immigration reform community includes whether you have an open border and get rid of ICE. Some people say this is all stolen land from Native Americans. Everyone should come in and out. And other people who say they more support what used to be a bipartisan consensus until the Trump era, when in fact Democrats and Republicans agreed in Congress that there still should be rules. Not everybody should be let in. More people should be let in. It should still be done as a process with more border security. That was the compromise. Thomas Friedman today has a column that says we should have a tall wall with a big gate, meaning we should let more people in, lots of people in, do it humanely, but we need rules, we need borders. Otherwise, we would not be able to handle, in other people's interest or our own interest, more people than we can handle on a haphazard way without rules. But other people say BS. They say these are people coming for a better life, usually fleeing oppression, and that they make our country stronger, wildly exaggerated claims about the dangers they bring. Who's right?
Well, I understand people's concerns about their own security. I respect that. I am not interested.
I don't mean our safety. That's a separate question.
Well, I mean, I think,
should there be rules? Should there be a border? Should we not just let everybody comes in, just get here on any terms when they want?
Yeah, and I think, you know, that comes from people's personal safety. We don't want more members of the gang coming here from Central America.
Okay,
we don't
want, but that's the easy part.
Sure.
Everyone agrees you don't let in MS-13 and all that kind of stuff, and we know the other side's exaggerated those stories. No one believes you bring in gang members or criminals.
Right.
But, you know, the vast majority of people aren't. There's still an honest debate about whether you have unlimited immigration and completely open borders or just a more forgiving and open process that still has rules and sometimes says no, separate from the criminal issue.
Sure.
And I think that's a tough question. And obviously the people who oppose Donald Trump's policies are united before they get to that question. Now, when you get to that question, it's very divisive.
It is. And there's also just, I think, some misinformation out there. If I have one more argument with someone about they're not crossing the right way or they're crossing illegally, it is a human right to present yourself at a border.
I don't think that part's dividing the immigration reform community.
But, you know,
what happens when you do?
Right. So
what should the rules be?
What we have done is, I mean, they are building walls in El Paso. They're fortifying walls, and they're barbing the top.
But again, that doesn't divide people who are on the side of immigrants.
Right. So
they don't believe, no one thinks you need more walls.
Right.
But some people do think you should still have rules that are enforced with security. The walls thing is just a distraction to pile up a base. But some people do think you need, you know, rules and saying no to some people and a process that's fairer. And other people really believe that that's bogus because we don't need borders, that that's not making us safer, that that's limiting opportunity, and our country's actually stronger with none of this.
I mean, the problem right now, I would say, is that our ports of entry are closing. So,
but again, that's nothing anyone agrees with on the immigration side.
Right, so
should we have borders and rules that say no to some people who aren't gang members?
But if we have borders, but our ports are closed, you can't get in. You can't seek asylum. I don't have a good answer for this.
It's a hard one.
Yeah, I
don't have a good answer either.
I would like to see more money being spent to move people through, and the tremendous backlog is a real problem. And the media is casting San Diego as these were violent, they'll probably call them illegals, but
violent, that's an exaggeration.
Yeah, violent asylum seekers throwing rocks. Well, they were tear gassed because they were exhausted waiting outside of the border. So all I can tell you.
Right, again, I wasn't questioning you on the merits of what the U.S. is doing. I'm talking about what you come next if the other side prevails.
Yeah, I think, and I don't know how we do this, and it may not happen until January when we have a more democratic House and Senate who can, the amount of money that's being sent there, not going to FEMA, not going to homeless shelters is, so I feel like that might be, like I said, I don't have an answer how to fix this, but if we can stop sending so much money, and I'm writing my representative, I've written my two senators, I've written our governor, I'm writing everybody, I'm meeting with local folks, anybody who will listen to me talk about this to say, what are you going to do to stop? We want to shut these tents down. But you're right, even just for the tents, we need a longer game plan, because then what happens? We shut it down and we have 4,000 children, what do? Mm-hmm. So we're going to need, if we can get it shut down, we are going to need reinforcements. I have worked with folks, asylum seekers, since August. I think it's important, if you have a negative opinion, to maybe sit down with them and listen to their story and listen to why they came here. There's, again, lots of misinformation that they're just here to steal our jobs. They're here to, get free handouts. They're not eligible for
any of that. We've seen how our community got stronger because we welcome immigrants. And as a grandson of a Jewish man who fled pogroms in Russia, Poland, obviously see from a different perspective, and, whose father was alive during the Holocaust when our country turned back boats of people who hadn't gone through the front door. But Harry Jost, who's on the Trump side, that says we are the United States of America, we have a nation of laws, we have an immigration system that allows over 1 million legal aliens. If we had a wall on that southern border, they wouldn't be able to throw rocks at our border agents. Have a big wall with door for legal entry. Homeland Security funding has nothing to do with homelessness in America. It doesn't dictate FEMA helping you. And you're saying there's a limited amount of money either way, and we can focus where we focus.
Yeah, I mean, the reason they're throwing rocks is because they just closed the port, and they're desperate, and they've been waiting there for weeks. They're hungry. We're not following our own laws.
The rock throwing was way exaggerated. I mean,
sure.
The Department of Homeland Security issued its own statement hours later after the right-wing crazy press started putting out these exaggerations, and it was the Trump team that dispelled the reaction.
But if you hop online and read the comment section, I don't recommend it.
Don't.
Any of those articles.
Oh, I love comments, but not about immigration.
Oh, why was that mother running with her children? Well, she was waiting peacefully, and she was tear gassed. What would you do? Yeah. I just the criticism is hard for me. I don't.
No, it's cruel.
It's absolutely cruel. And I consider myself a Christian. And I went to the rally, the small rally we had a couple nights ago, I guess it was Monday night, and I held up a sign with a picture of that mom and those two children, and I said, what would Jesus do? This isn't, I haven't figured out how to bring the right over. I don't know. If I knew, I could be, running for office or doing something much more
right
powerful.
Now, you are Lori Sweet, appearing on Dateline New Haven, WNHH, 103.5 FM, live stream, newhavenbend.org, talking about your visit. You just got back to your pilgrimage to New York, Texas, looking at the tent city for migrant teens. So, Lori Sweet, what are you doing now? You went to the rally Monday in downtown New Haven.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned something about working with a family. Tell me about that.
Yeah, so as part of my work for Immigrant Families Together, on a daily basis, we're doing rapid response. I'm going to be transporting some immigrants who are arriving here soon by bus up to their final destination in the Northeast. I have a family that I'm sponsoring right now, so I'm working on getting them a lawyer to represent them for their asylum case, working on getting them health care. Very, very difficult because they don't qualify for custody.
Navigating bureaucracy is a killer for those of us who live here already and know the language. Yeah,
it's very tough, and I've been pretty saddened with some of our experiences with some care providers who work in this field and haven't treated me very well. And I just say to them, you know, you're not speaking very nicely to me about making an appointment. And I'm not even the mom who has scars on her body from, you know, gang violence. How are you going to treat her when she's in your facility?
So you're in this for the long haul, Lori.
Oh, yeah, I'm not going.
So what keeps you motivated?
I'm not going anywhere.
I mean, before Nasty Women emerged in 2017, you were not someone who spent your days. You did care about your community a lot. You were helping organize the Westville Community Nursing School, great institution in Westville. You care, you're raising two children.
Yep.
Why are you now signed up in the long haul to push for immigration reform and day-to-day help families stay in America?
Yeah, so for the last 7 years, I worked as a birth doula, and I loved that job.
That's a really interesting field.
It was pretty crazy.
So you helped keep women alive.
Yeah, I helped moms have babies, and this particular family that I'm working with, there's a baby, so he's near and dear to my heart. And I think this is an extension of that work. It can be hard to be a birth doula in a medical setting, which is usually where I am. People are always surprised when things go smoothly and I'm helping the mom out. They're like, oh, wow, that was great. I'm like, that's my job. That's what I'm here to do. So, but this rapid response part of Immigrant Families Together is something I'm very comfortable with. Having to react quickly, having to book a flight for someone whose change of address form was rejected by the Texas court, even though it's the form they gave him and he's residing in New York. So it's midnight and I'm booking him a flight to fly the next day to Brownsville, Texas to appear at a master calendar hearing right up my alley. Very, you know, last minute, quick response and also kind of behind the scenes. Those are the pieces of this particular work that I really like, and I can see the change that we're making in these families' lives. The mom I'm helping is heading to therapy for the second time.
Where is she from?
By herself, Honduras.
And she and her children, is she with her husband too?
Yeah, and her baby. And it took us a month to get these appointments. It took a lot of perseverance.
And they're here fighting deportation.
They do not have a deportation order. They are here
seeking asylum,
correct. And that's going to be a long road for them.
And final websites you want people to check about how to get involved?
Sure. So Witness:Tornillo is a great group if you're interested in seeing for yourself what is happening in the tent city. The Annunciation House is a wonderful organization. You can just search Annunciation House El Paso. If you want to give to the organization that I'm working with, it's immigrantfamiliestogether.com, and that's the group that's doing that rapid response thing. So we're, you know, delivering groceries, reuniting moms and children, doing a lot of driving. I do a lot of driving. I'm okay with that. I really like my car. So Immigrant Families Together is another wonderful organization, and the group organizing our trip was Faith in Action. So if you want to check them out, they're awesome too.
Well, thanks so much, Lori Sweet.
Thank you
for coming in. It's always nice to have you here.
Yeah, thank you.
Studio, and thanks for listening, folks. We're going to take it out with the Afro-Semitic Experience performing "I Wish I Knew How It Would Feel to Be Free." It's from the group CD, "A Plea for Peace." Now we know what it's like to be free. We just got to remember to book our flight. Fly free with us all day and night here at WNHH, New Haven's home for community radio.